Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
I'm going to warn you, this sounds like the stuff of a dystopian novel. A government agency rounding up dogs sheltered in a city pound in Texas, pulling up with those dogs to a garbage dump, testing the lethality of cyanide spray by setting it off in the animals' mouths and laughing at their suffering. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. That wasn't standard policy of the USDA department known as Animal Services, not to be confused with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But it did happen, according to former employees, and it went unpunished. The agency exists largely to protect domesticated animals grazing on public lands from wild predators, for example, to keep sheep safe from marauding wolves. But many critics say it is often both unnecessary and ineffective to kill native species in order to protect ranchers' investments. Night science journalism fellow Christopher Ketchum reported on this for Harper's Magazine. His article, The Rogue Agency, appears in the March issue. Chris, welcome to Think.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you. The USDA website says the mission of wildlife services is, and this is a quote, to provide federal leadership and expertise to resolve wildlife conflicts to allow people and wildlife to coexist. Your report doesn't make it sound like coexistence is a priority.
No, it's not a priority. You know, Wildlife Services was founded in or took shape as the Bureau of Economic Ornithology back in the late 1890s, and its singular purpose was to help Forest Service employees kill wolves that threatened the livestock industry across the American West. And so it has always retained that that purpose of destroying predators and those animals deemed pests by ranchers, especially on public lands. So yes, this notion of coexistence with wildlife is basically a lie, and you know, when you really look at what Wildlife Services does, it's a it's an atrocity against wildlife. So yeah, they service wildlife by killing them.
The story that I told in the introduction came from your piece, and honestly, it's so bizarre that it almost doesn't make sense without context. Can you tell us a little bit more about what was going on in Uvalde?
Okay, yeah. So that story was told to me by a guy named Rex Shaddix, who worked for 17 months for Wildlife Services in Uvalde, Texas, and currently works for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department as a law enforcement officer. And so Shaddix described how his supervisor, a guy named Charles Brown, who's now the Eastern Regional Director for Wildlife Services, called his men together on a morning, you know, early morning, to meet at the dump outside of town, where a truck pulled up with a bunch of abandoned dogs from the local pound, and Brown proceeded to test a tool that's used by Wildlife Services agents in the field. It's a device called the M44. It's a spring-loaded trap that when nudged at or touched by usually a canine, usually coyotes, it ejects a white spray of sodium cyanide, and that sodium cyanide has pretty horrific effects on canids, killing them, you know, in a brutal manner where they blood pours from their mouths and their ears, and they vomit and scream and then die. So what this Charles Brown did was he took one of the dogs from the pound truck and released the M44 device into the mouths of one of the animals, and that animal proceeded to go a little mad in what seemed to be death throes, and then Brown tested the antidote, which is amyl nitrite, on the same animal, and the animal calmed down, covered in blood that had poured from its mouth, and then this is what Shaddix told me. It was unbelievable to me too when I heard it. And then Brown decided, you know what, let's kill this dog, and released another dose of sodium cyanide from an M44 into this collie's mouth. And the collie kicks and screams and in the hysterical fits of cyanide poisoning. And then Brown kicks the animal into a garbage heap at which point the other trappers, as they're known in wildlife services, begin cackling with laughter. This is according to Rex Shaddix's account.
Were you able to get anybody else to confirm that account?
No. Hmm. No, I wasn't. I wasn't. But, well, actually, Wildlife Services confirmed it. They said, yes, there was a test on a single dog at Uvalde, at the Uvalde pound. They didn't confirm the details, but they said, yes, there was. Charles Brown did indeed test a M44 device on a dog at the city dump in Uvalde. So, yeah, I got a confirmation from, you know, straight from the horse's mouth. But, you know, there was no confirmation on the details that Shaddix provided. You know, the cruelty of it and the baseness, the callousness, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, Shaddix described how there's a whole culture within wildlife services of cruelty towards animals, a cruelty toward the natural world. And how could that not be if your job is to kill animals, you know, and kill animals in ways that in past years have been very barbaric. For example, one of the methods that Wildlife Services has been documented to use is they go to a coyote den and they'll have a string of barbed wire and reach into the den and then grab the pups with the barbed wire and then strangle them by hand or club them. You know, there have been pictures of coyote fetuses lined up to form numbers, like the number of coyotes killed in the area. Just bizarre stuff that, you know, that like. What it's just as Shaddix and others who have worked in wildlife services described it, it's part of a culture of brutality towards the natural world.
How many wild animals has the agency killed in recent years at the behest of commercial industry, either agriculture or, I guess, aviation?
Well, since 2000, 2 million native mammals, many of which have been listed have been listed as either endangered or threatened. 15 million birds. I mean, the slaughter of birds by wildlife services does seem to have a point to protect the public the public taking jetliners. I mean, sparrows and starlings and the like can get caught in jet engines. That happened in New York City a couple of years ago, famously when a pilot had to land on the Hudson River. So that actually does pose a danger to the public, and so Wildlife Services work there is actually, you know, could be rationally justified. But the slaughter of the native mammals, I mean, a lot of these, you know, we're talking about everything from crows and ravens to ground squirrels, pocket gophers, prairie dogs, wolves, coyotes, bears, mountain lions. I mean, you name it, the whole range of animals that this single industry, the cattle and sheep industry, considers to be getting in the way of, you know, their profits and their exploitation of public lands grass.
Wait, are pocket gophers and prairie dogs a threat to sheep?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Are they? Well, no. Okay, so the ranching industry considers gophers and prairie dogs to be competitors for forage because they will eat some of the same plants that cows will eat. Additionally, prairie dogs create dens that in which cattle and horses can catch their hooves and then break their legs. So that's a problem. But compare what prairie dogs do in terms of ecosystem services, the incredible importance of this keystone species to grasslands. So, so beavers, for example, beavers are slaughtered en masse by wildlife services because they dam up rivers, and those rivers are needed to be diverted for hay production and for watering of cattle.
How is it, Chris, that no exceptions are made for animals on the endangered species list? On the one hand, we have some government agencies trying to protect things like gray wolves, and on the other hand, it sounds like you've got this agency within the USDA that is killing them.
Right, because there are exceptions written into the reintroduction rules that were created by Congress. The wolf reintroduction rules created by Congress in the 1990s basically created loopholes for the killing of wolves, even in, you know, wolves protected under the Endangered Species Act, if those wolves are shown to have preyed upon any livestock. So that's why. And now, on the other hand, there are a lot of accidental poisonings and killings of animals on the endangered species list. And some of those are disclosed. I'm told that that a lot of those accidental killings of endangered and threatened species are not disclosed under a policy in wildlife services known as shoot, shovel, and shut up, which means that if you accidentally kill a bald eagle, well, just keep quiet about it. Get rid of the cadaver and walk on.
In fact, you write about a case where some bald eagles were apparently accidentally poisoned by a rancher. He reported it. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service went to investigate just to figure out what happened. And then they didn't get cooperation from wildlife services.
That's right, because wildlife services told the investigators at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that this was a client of theirs. And so, the investigator who led that case, Doug McKenna, is now retired, and he spent almost a quarter century investigating wildlife crimes in the West, and particularly as it relates to wildlife services. Was astonished. He said, "We're one federal agency looking to another federal agency for help in investigating a serious crime, and we got stonewalled by that agency. Wildlife services did nothing to help that investigation."
You say a client. Do people have to pay Wildlife Services if they call them up and say, "Hey, there's
Well, that's their terminology. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, they're not clients. They're Wildlife Services funding is a labyrinthine process. It's not entirely clear how it works. There's a lot of opacity there. Congress funds portions of the lethal control budget. Local counties have levies that add into that budget. Some ranchers are known as cooperators, and they will help pay into the budget for lethal control. So, yes, in some cases, ranchers are paying in part for this service. Okay. Now, and the thing about it is, on the county level, there a lot of money goes into, and in fact, a lot of county councilmen, county legislators don't even know that there's this little line item in a lot of their budgets that takes directly from property taxes. Instead of going to schools, it's going to fund this program to kill wildlife on behalf of an industry that provides almost no jobs and no tax revenue for most of those counties. And I'm talking about the public lands ranching industry here, which is the industry most heavily served by Wildlife Services.
Do they operate only on publicly owned lands? Like if I have a ranch, can I call them onto my private property and have them?
Yeah, of course, yes. No, they operate if you're a stockman and you need help with coyote depredations or wolves or whatever, or the evil prairie dog menace, then, the Wildlife Services will come in and help you out. I mean, there's a story. I wrote a companion piece at harpers.org. In which I describe the story of a woman named Angel Walker in Texas. She found her dog, Bella, dead 90 feet from an M44 trap that was placed on a rancher's private land just adjacent to her property, or property she was leasing. And it turned out the rancher the Wildlife Services agent who placed that trap there was working for his dad or his grandfather or some family relation to kill coyotes on that private property.
We're speaking this hour with Christopher Ketchum, a fellow at MIT's Night Science Journalism Program, who wrote a story for the March issue of Harper's Magazine called The Rogue Agency. It's about the Wildlife Services Agency. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org. Find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Christopher Ketchum. He wrote a story for the March issue of Harper's Magazine called The Rogue Agency. It's about the USDA program known as Wildlife Services. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Chris, I've never farmed or ranched, but I get it. It must be very distressing to see your investments eaten by predators. What do we know for sure about the numbers of livestock animals killed by bears and wolves and coyotes and what have you every year?
Well, we don't have very good numbers simply because most of the numbers come from the National Agricultural Statistics Service, which gets its numbers from self-reporting by ranchers. Now, one of the guys I spoke to, and self-reporting meaning literally these are ranchers saying, all right, 20 of my sheep were killed by wolves this month or whatever the number might be. And so the process of confirming those kills is rather suspect, according to several sources I spoke to for the piece, including most notably a guy named Carter Niemeyer, who's spent 25 years with the agency and tried to conduct serious investigations of ranchers' claims of depredations. And oftentimes he found, Niemeyer, that is, found that that his colleagues would simply just take the ranchers' reports and not even attempt to do a serious investigation of the veracity. So we don't know exactly what the numbers are. There are claims that 500,000 sheep and cattle are killed each year by wolves and other predators. I mean, and a lot, we're talking about everything from wild feral dogs to mountain lions to coyotes, et cetera, bears, grizzlies, black bears. But again, the numbers are they've not been confirmed properly by any true scientific measure. For example, the NAS reported in Idaho in 1 year, I think in 2010 or 2011, something like 4,500 cattle killed by wolves. When the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service tried to do an independent confirmation of that, they could only confirm 75 or something like that. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but some ridiculously, vanishingly small. Small number of confirmations as opposed to the self-reported claims by the industry.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Donna in Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Chris. Excuse me. I am chewing some toast. I could barely eat and barely listen to this show, but I forced myself to because I know it's important. It's sickening, especially the first story that the gentleman told about those people laughing. I mean, as a dog lover, as an animal lover, I'm sickened by it. So I'll cut to the chase. What can we do about it? I deeply resent my tax dollars going to support this kind of inhumanity. And, okay, one, what can we do about it to stop it? And two, what did Native Americans do in this regard? I'm sure they had a more humane way of dealing with predators.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I'll answer the last question first. Native Americans didn't have problems with predators because the prey base for those predators was enormous. When Euro-Americans settled the West, they decimated elk populations, pronghorn and deer populations, through overhunting and market hunting. They destroyed almost to entirety the bison herds that had fed predators across the West for millennia. So when the native ungulates of the West were replaced with the invasive ungulates of Euro-American civilization, namely cattle and sheep, predators turned to those cattle and sheep for food since their native prey base had been disappeared by greed and exploitation. So Native Americans didn't have a problem with predators. I mean, of course, there's always the occasional attack on human beings by predators, but, a rare event. Now, to answer your question about what can be done, well, a number of things. Talk to your congressperson and ask about this program. Go to a website called PredatorDefense.org, which is run by a guy named Brooks Fay. Brooks is the guy who's really been on top of watchdogging wildlife services for decades. And Brooks has compiled, and since you're a dog owner, this is germane to our conversation. Brooks has compiled dozens, if not scores, of accounts of pet owners who have either confirmed or suspect that their dogs were killed by a wildlife service trap, either a neck snare, a leg snare, or a wildlife services poison trap, M44, or wildlife services use of a horrific poison called sodium fluoroacetate, also known as compound 1080. So that's two things to do. Contact Brooks Fay and talk to him and ask him what you can do, because his organization is spearheading efforts to stop wildlife services through legislation in Congress. Talk to your – go and look at the budget, the line items in the budget in your county, and see if there are any – if there's any budgeting from for predator control. And then talk to your county representatives and say, hey, why are we funding this? Why shouldn't this should all be going to schools and to, you know, to beneficial things, not for waste and cruelty? So that I think that's a start anyway.
Is anybody talking about the environmental hazards, if there are any, of putting things like cyanide into spray traps and compound 1080 into, you know, things that wild animals can come across, but certainly, you know, theoretically anybody could come across?
Well, yeah, there have been numerous cases over the years of people accidentally tripping M44 traps. There's a guy named Dennis Slaw, who I interviewed years ago and did a profile of, who was rock hounding outside Vernal, Utah, on his ATV and saw this curious-looking thing in the ground, a little what looked like a pipe sticking out of the ground, and then, you know, just reached out to touch it, and bang, sprayed cyanide all over his chest and up into his mouth. He's been sick ever since. He nearly died. His body's starved of oxygen. He's perpetually dizzy and weak. And the cyanide poisoning is slowly killing him. So there was another guy who, where was he? I forget where that case happened. But there was another man who in a letter to, I think to Predator Defense, described how he saw again this curious object in the soil on public land, and then went down to trip it, and it turned out to be a type of M44 that was known as a coyote. It was old school M44, known as a coyote getter. So it's like a little gun stuck in the ground with a .38 special cartridge in it that then fires off when sprung. So he nearly lost his hand, and if he was placed directly in front of the device, it probably would have killed him. And he likened these devices to landmines on the public lands. Now, there's another story about a dog that accidentally ate from a sheep carcass that was poisoned with compound 1080, and the dog went absolutely crazy. The owner didn't know what was going on. They were on a river trip on the White River in Utah, and the dog leaps into the water, howling, swimming in circles, swims to the far shore, swims back to the near shore, then collapses, cardiac arrest, vomiting, blood. And this was just a couple of years ago. And this is compound 1080, which was banned by Nixon in 1972. They're not supposed to be using it, yet it's still being used out on our public lands. So, yeah, in the environmental threat, years ago, there was a guy who wrote a book, Jack Olson, who was a writer for Sports Illustrated, of all places. He serialized his book, which is Slaughter the Animals, Poison the Earth, which is a whole history of wildlife services to that point. The book was published in 1971. And he basically described, contaminated watersheds and just poisoned carcasses all across the land, and poisoned baits of 1080 and sodium cyanide spread across the land. And sure, so environmental hazards indeed on our public lands. That's the incredible thing about it. This is our land. This is the shared commons of the American people. And meanwhile, a private industry is poisoning our commons for private profit.
You write about a rancher in Idaho who has 7,000 head of sheep, and he says he loses about 200 a year to predation by wild animals, I gather mostly wolves. Are the margins so tight that that number makes a big difference in terms of his ability to make a living?
Well, first of all, I don't know if I trust his numbers. Mm-hmm. Those are his claims. But the margins of sheep ranching, I'm not an expert in sheep ranching, so I couldn't tell you. I mean, I do not know. What I know is what he told me, that, you know, he has to, that in order to make money from his operation, he has to use public forage, public grass, and public lands, because hay production and having a whole hay growing operation is too expensive. So basically, in order to make a profit, he has to be subsidized by the public on public land, with the additional subsidy of wildlife services agents coming in and killing wolves that prey on his sheep that he leaves to stray far and wide out on the range without any protections. Which, as Carter Niemeyer remarks in the piece, and Niemeyer knows that rancher. His name is John Peavy. He ranches in central Idaho, near Ketchum, Idaho. You know, Niemeyer remarks, this is almost animal cruelty. You're leaving your animals out in the middle of nowhere, no protections, nobody around. I mean, of course they're going to get eaten by wolves. It's literally a sign saying, eat me.
So, Chris, what's the alternative? What else could be done to protect, particularly like baby lambs that can't move very fast, from potential predators who are out there?
Just shed lamb them. Just get them off the public lands.
So, in other words, you can put them on a farm that is owned, or on a ranch that is owned by the person who is raising them, rather than putting them on public lands.
There you go.
Okay.
And just put up a lot of fences, and, you know, you can spend money on lights and warning signs, and, you know, have big old sheepdogs out there, and, you know, actually spend money, you know, actually invest time and money in your operation rather than parasitically feeding off the public lands in order to make a profit.
So Petey, this rancher, says he's experimented with non-lethal control methods for predators, and they've been unsuccessful. What did he tell you he had attempted?
Oh, you know, he smoked pots, which is 55-gallon drums with fire in it, lights, flagry, which is a type of torn, shredded fabric that for some reason scares canids, range riders, so men on horseback in the area to make sure that wolves and coyotes don't get close. You know, he claims anyways that he's tried all these methods. I don't know. Over the years, I've taken a dim view of ranchers' claims.
How are animals killed by wildlife services disposed of?
They used to be, as Carter Niemeyer described, they used to be, they would strip the pelts and sell the pelts, and then the bodies, I guess, just dumped. Oftentimes, the carcasses are either left on the public lands, or they are they're gathered up and dumped somewhere. I'm not sure where they're dumped, but I know that in some cases they're gathered up.
When you say sell the pelts, are you talking about like individual agents are keeping these and making money, or the agency itself?
Yeah, that is the agency itself has sold pelts, and individual agents used to do it. Now the coyote pelts don't fetch much money now, so it's not as profitable.
Okay, so
yes, they used to.
If a call goes into wildlife services and someone says, "I've lost X number of animals, I need you to come in here," does the agency make an attempt to find, to identify the guilty party? Like maybe there's, you know, one wolf that is causing all the problems and the other ones are not so problematic.
No, usually the lethal control order has a line in it saying kill all offending wolves. And there's no effort made to determine, you know, exactly which wolf in a wolf pack is killed. So, for example, an activist in the Sun Valley area near Ketchum named Lynn Stone told me a story of four wolf pups that were in a culvert that were killed by wildlife services. and that were part of this all-encompassing rubric of offending wolves, right? Well, okay, so members of that pack that were feeding those wolf pups that were holed up in a culvert for protection and survival, some of the members of that pack obviously did kill a sheep or two, but all of the wolves were killed, including the four pups. Now, as Lynn Stone asked, well, how can these pups be offending? I mean, they're totally dependent on their pack to feed them. So as I understand it, no, there's not much effort made to distinguish, you know, which wolf did what. I mean, in terms of coyotes, the indiscriminate killing is even worse. Wildlife Services has a policy of preemptive killing of coyotes. So they will all winter long, for example, there will be aerial gunners out in helicopters and in airplanes just gunning down coyotes as they see them. And these coyotes haven't eaten sheep, haven't attacked any livestock. They're just killed because they're expected to do so. So the preemptive slaughter of coyotes, yeah, goes on every year and results in a massive toll, something like between 60,000 and 75,000 coyotes killed each year.
Without those coyotes on the landscape, are there, say, too many rabbits or whatever other kind of small prey that they might be going after?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There's, you know, there are always going to be wildlife eruptions when you get rid of predators. Coyotes will control squirrel populations. They will control all sorts of rodent populations. Lagomorph, the rabbit populations, will be controlled by coyotes. So yeah, you will have eruptions of prey species without the presence of predators, both top predators and what are called mesopredators, middle line predators like coyotes.
We're speaking this hour with Christopher Ketchum, a fellow at MIT's Night Science Journalism Program and author of a story in the March issue of Harper's Magazine called The Rogue Agency. It's about Wildlife Services, a division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. If you'd like to join our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist Christopher Ketchum, who wrote about a USDA program called Wildlife Services that kills wild animals for the March issue of Harper's Magazine. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Chris, I know that what you've been describing has been very disturbing for some listeners. Others may see these killings as justifiable if they protect the livestock industry, but you found evidence that this kind of culling may not actually work to reduce incidences of livestock being killed by predators.
That's right. There have been a number of studies in recent years that have found that when you disrupt wildlife population or predator populations, rather, you actually increase the number of attacks on livestock. And that's because of literally the disruption to what are very orderly population groups. With cougars, for example, you start to kill off adult male cougars, and younger cougars come in, and they will start spreading out in ways that they hadn't before, and taking prey that those older adult males that had sort of kept order in the population hadn't done. So coyote populations are very similar. You disrupt those family groups, and just they're thrown into chaos. And the Wildlife Services agents have told me that you kill a bunch of coyotes in a given area, and depredations on sheep go through the roof. Hmm. Now, so it seems counterintuitive, right? Paradox, but there it is. And the only way to really reduce depredations from predators is to really slaughter the heck out of them till their populations are reduced to almost nothing. Then your depredations will obviously go down. But we don't want to do that, right? We want to have so-called balance. The other argument that's made by folks who want to get rid of predators or at least control their populations is that the predators will go out of control. Their population will spiral exponentially, which is simply not true. The predator populations in general will self-regulate. If you look at wolf packs, for example, wolf packs mercilessly kill each other off to self-regulate and keep their numbers at a kind of a steady state. In California, there have been years and years of protections for cougars, and the cougar population hasn't gone through the roof. Now, granted, there have been a lot of cougars killed on highways and as a result of civilization, but nonetheless, the scientific evidence increasingly shows that we do not need to be hunting predators, that their populations control themselves, and that predators will prey on sheep and livestock, that's for sure. But when we have to make a value judgment, do we want to have wild animals on our public lands who represent a incredible natural heritage that belongs to all the American people? Or do we want to kill off those animals in order to protect an industry that produces less than 2% of all national beef, that really has very little relevance to Western economies? It's a choice, it's a choice that we're going to have to make at some point, which way to go.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Justin on the line in Midlothian. Hi, Justin.
Hi, how are you all?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for talking about this and writing the article. When I was in college, I worked for Wildlife Services, and I did an internship for a year when I was in with them as well. And I think it's a very important article. You cannot condone some of the things that have been found and written about. But to vilify the organization and the institution, I think, is a little bit incorrect. They do have problems, but I do think they serve a need that is unfortunate and not very happy-go-lucky, but is somewhat necessary in some cases.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Chris?
I think we should vilify the agency. I think they're a terrible agency that does terrible things, and I think they, in terms of the majority of their operations are aimed against, are aimed to serve the livestock industry by killing these basically innocent animals. So I'm sorry. I think they should be vilified. As I noted earlier in this conversation, Wildlife Services does do some socially beneficial work, or at least you can perceive it that way, by protecting commercial airliner traffic. We don't want people, we don't want planes full of people crashing because a bunch of starlings get caught in the engine. All right. So that makes sense. But that's my feeling after having spent a long time investigating these guys and having spent a lot of time talking with former employees. Now, maybe the former employees I talked to were extremely disgruntled. Maybe that's it. Maybe there are many others out there who work for Wildlife Services who just loved it. But I didn't talk to them.
One person you did talk to was Pete DeFazio, a congressman from Oregon, who has been trying for years to restrict the activities of Wildlife Services, cut their funding. What kinds of legislative strategies has he attempted, and why haven't they resulted in much change?
Well, over the years, since 1998, he has proposed, I think, four or five different pieces of legislation or amendments to legislation to reduce the funding for lethal control for Wildlife Services, to prohibit Wildlife Services use of M44 and its continued use of compound 1080, specifically in what are known as sheep collars. So it's illegal just to use 1080 on the landscape, but you can still put 1080 in a collar on a sheep. And when that collar is burst by a predator, the 1080 will then kill that predator. So that's still in use. He is just over, let's say, 1998 to present. He has on many occasions tried and failed to rein in wildlife services simply because the power of the livestock industry in Congress is too great. They just will not let it happen. So, for example, there was one vote in 1998 in which the House voted to cut funding for wildlife services. The American Farm Bureau went into action. The livestock industry's lobbyists went into action, and the vote was reversed, which DeFazio remarked he had rarely seen in Congress in, you know, two decades in Congress.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Dick on the line at DFW. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Chris. Really enjoying the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I have a question for Mr. Ketchum, and I may have the numbers wrong, but you were especially talking about the Wildlife Service's annual kill of coyotes. I don't know if it was 50,000 or 500,000.
Between 65,000 and 75,000 on average per year.
Okay. I was wondering how that affects the overall population annually, and if it was stopped, where do you think the national or population out west of the coyotes would end up at?
Well, this is an interesting thing. I've heard from numerous sources that we don't have an exact count that actually coyote populations in the 17 western states are at record highs despite all this slaughter. So in the Harper's piece, I referenced the work of a guy named Robert Crabtree, who's the founder of the Yellowstone Ecological Research Center. And what he found is that when you kill, when you disrupt coyote populations and slaughter their groups, they actually will compensate with bigger litters. There'll actually be more coyotes as a result. So it's like, you know, they're hard to get rid of. So coyote numbers would probably just stabilize at a steady state in relation to their prey base if left alone, to answer your question. But again, the irony here is delicious that every year, I mean, look, from 2000 to present, we're talking about an average, let's say, 75,000 coyotes killed. That's almost 2 million coyotes. And what has it done? Nothing. Nothing. There coyotes are out there. They're everywhere.
Did you meet ranchers who wouldn't think of calling wildlife services?
No.
It's just accepted as a practice among people.
It's a way to do it. Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Ed on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Excuse me. Talking about things that don't disappear, the feral hogs that are now appearing in the state of Texas and here in Dallas in the southern part of the city, do you know what is being done before they start going into other districts?
Does Wildlife Services deal with feral hogs?
Yes, it does, and that's actually a good thing because feral hogs are a real problem. So yeah, I don't know the exact numbers. I didn't look into it, but I did. You can read on their website their feral hog control work, as they call it.
All right, let's go to Mark in Hearst. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Got to tell you, Chris, it's programs like this that really make NPR worthwhile, and I really appreciate your taking this on as a topic today. This one might make a little bit of discomfort for listeners, but I got to ask, if people were to adopt more of a plant-based vegan lifestyle, wouldn't this problem kind of go away?
What do you think, Chris?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question because how much is the consumer market driving this, right? And I don't think very much because, again, when you look at public lands ranching, it produces very little actual beef in relation to total national beef production. Less than 2% of all beef is husbanded on the public lands of the American West. So, and it's on those public lands where, as we've been discussing, most of the control work, the lethal control work of wildlife services occurs. So, no, I don't think stopping eating beef would have very much effect on wildlife services operations. On the other hand, if you want to get big picture here, you know, beef eating is very destructive, and animal agriculture is extremely destructive to the water, air, soil. It's a huge source of methane gas, the most powerful of all the greenhouse gases. So, I mean, yeah, I would urge listeners to stop eating beef and animals. I have, anyway, just because over the years, this reporting on this industry, I've just found that, you know, there's no way to report on animal agriculture and then go and order a steak. It's just not possible.
By this time, I imagine our listeners are wondering what Wildlife Service's executives had to say in response to your investigation. Tell us
very
what happened
little.
There. Yeah.
Very little. I asked to go out on a lethal control operation with them. They refused. I sent them a series of 35 questions that were not really answered. I was referred to PR templates on their website. I was not allowed an interview with the director of Wildlife Services, and I was not allowed an interview with the, much of the story that I write in Harper's takes place in Idaho. So I wanted to speak to the Idaho State Director of Wildlife Services, a guy named Todd Grimm. I was not allowed to do that. As Peter DeFazio has remarked, the Wildlife Services is incredibly secretive. They don't want the public to know what they're doing, because if the public knows what they're doing, the public will rise up and say stop. Or at least I hope so.
How did this initially get on your radar screen so that you started your reporting, your in-depth reporting on this? It's been a while.
Well, I was it's been a while. I mean, there was a story in 2005 that I did for Men's Journal about the man we spoke about earlier who was accidentally poisoned by an M44 trap near Vernal, Utah. That's Dennis Slaw. Mm-hmm. So I heard his story and then began investigating Wildlife Services then. Then, you know, Wildlife Service is a branch of the Animal, Plant, and Health Inspection Service of the USDA. And APHIS, as it's known, also deals with bison populations rather cruelly and barbarically with bison populations in Yellowstone National Park. So in 2008, I did an investigation of the bison policies in Yellowstone for Harper's. And so, again, came across the wonderful work of Wildlife Services. So it's been a long, long road. I mean, I'm writing a book on this subject. So,
Christopher Ketchum is a fellow at MIT's Knight Science Journalism Program. His article, The Rogue Agency, is in the March issue of Harper's. Chris, it's been really interesting. Thank you for spending this time with us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.